and radio host out of New York and out of Minneapolis, Jack Rice, a lawyer and media analyst. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another debate. I'm Marzia Hashemi.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Please listen to verses 9 to 11 of chapter Hud from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Sayyid Ahmad Mirzadeh Waqifi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. وَلَئِنْ أَذَقْنَا الْإِنسَانَ مِنَّا رَحْمَةً ثُمَّ نَزَعْنَاهَا مِنْهُ لئن أذقناه نعماء بعد ضراء مسته ليقولن ذهب السيئات عني إنه لفرح فخور إلا الذين صبروا وعملوا الصالحات أولئك لهم مغفرة وأجر كبير إلا الذين صبروا وعملوا الصالحات أولئك لهم مغفرة وأجر كبير صدق الله العلي
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. And if we make man taste mercy from us, then take it off from him, most surely he is despairing, ungrateful. And if we make him taste a favor after distress has afflicted him, he will certainly say, "The evils are gone away from me." Most surely, he is exulting, boasting. Except those who are patient and do good. They shall have forgiveness and a great reward.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines: Iran's foreign minister condemns the latest U.S. sanctions against Turkey as Washington's a contempt for international law. Bomb attack in Afghanistan's capital Kabul kills the city's deputy governor and injures two of his guards. And U.S. President-elect Joe Biden slams incumbent Donald Trump for, quote, refusing to accept the will of the people. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisum Shahmat, and these are our top stories this hour. Iran's foreign minister strongly condemns U.S. sanctions against Turkey over its purchase of Russian S-400 missile defense systems. Mohammad Javad Zarif said the U.S. move once again puts its addiction to sanctions and contempt for international law at full display. The sanctions target a major Turkish defense procurement and development body, along with its president and three employees. Ankara called the U.S. move inexplicable and pledged to retaliate. Russia also called the sanctions another manifestation of the U.S. arrogant attitude towards international law. Moscow and Washington have been pursuing the illegitimate and unilateral measures for years. NATO member Turkey acquired the Russian missile system in mid-2019. NATO claims that the system poses a threat to the alliance. Political analyst James Jaffers says the U.S. sanctions policy is counterproductive as it drives away Washington's allies.
But I don't really see what the moral or legal justification is for saying, you bought a system we don't like from a country we don't like, therefore we're going to sanction you. But unfortunately, this has become the entrenched attitude here in Washington. Sometimes I think policymakers in Washington have a list of countries they want to alienate, and push into an opposing camp in Eurasia with the Russians and the Chinese and the Iranians and other countries that, for some reason, Washington insists on trying to alienate and treat as enemies. Now, Turkey is at least nominally a member of NATO, even though they don't get along with the Russians on many things, for example, in the Caucasus and in Syria, for example. They were nonetheless going to find themselves more closely aligned with Moscow. And again, this is not unusual for American policy. Look at the way Washington still is trying to tank the Nord Stream 2 pipeline to Germany, which is our most important European ally. So it seems that there's something self-defeating almost about this kind of crass, crude assertiveness of American policy toward so-called allies.
The deputy governor of the Afghan capital, Kabul, has been killed in a bomb attack. Mahbubullah Mohabbi was traveling in Kabul when he came under attack. Officials say unknown assailants attached a sticky bomb to his car. Another person was also killed and two security guards got hurt in the blast. There has been no claim of responsibility yet. Last week, a government prosecutor was shot dead in eastern Kabul while he was on his way to work. Violence has surged in Afghanistan in the past few weeks. That comes as the government and Taliban militants are engaged in talks to hammer out a lasting peace deal. U.S. President-elect Joe Biden calls on Americans to turn the page on the current administration after Electoral College confirmed his victory over Donald Trump.
306 electoral votes is the same number of electoral votes that Donald Trump and Vice President Pence received when they won in 2016. At the time, President Trump called his the Electoral College tally a landslide. By his own standards, these numbers represented a clear victory then, and I respectfully suggest they do so now.
Anyone didn't know before, they know now.
Biden accused Trump of refusing to respect the will of the people. Earlier, Biden secured 306 Electoral College votes, exceeding 270-vote threshold needed to win. Trump said late last month that he would leave the White House if the Electoral College voted for Biden. He and his campaign still cast doubt on the fairness of the November 3rd presidential vote. Trump also filed plenty of lawsuits claiming that many votes were cast illegally in swing states. His claims of widespread fraud have also led to street brawls across the country. Several senior Republican senators in the U.S. have acknowledged Joe Biden as president-elect. That comes even as incumbent Donald Trump prepares for a last-ditch push to reverse the result. The Senate's number two Republican, John Thune, said it is time to move on. He warned that any attempt in Congress to overturn the results would also fail. Another veteran Republican, Senator John Cornyn, says any such attempt is a bad mistake that would be defeated. Trump's loyalist chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Lindsey Graham, also recognized Biden as president-elect. The U.S. Electoral College confirmed Biden's victory on Monday. Congress should certify electoral count on January the 6th. Trump has almost no chance of overturning the outcome, as Biden has enough support in both chambers of Congress.
The United States doesn't elect their leader by a popular vote, but by an electoral college. And that group has just chosen Democrat Joe Biden to be the president-elect of the United States. Biden was selected amid bitter, unfinished, but as yet unproven accusations of massive electoral fraud. Polls consistently show that around 35% of the country believes Biden won due to voter fraud, and the challenges to the nation's electoral integrity seem certain to continue until January 6th, when Congress officially counts the electoral votes.
Trump is going to just keep going on doing what he does, and that's not to the benefit of the country, but obviously we're just moving along, following the rules, and hopefully the democracy is strong enough to keep going.
President Biden is going to be in office. It's time for a change. He's gone. Good. Goodbye.
It now seems unlikely that incumbent Donald Trump can reverse Biden's projected win, and many wonder if Republicans in this gun-filled nation will take to the streets in protest. For months, domestic media stoked fears that a lot of right-wing violence will occur should Trump lose.
A lot, no. Could there be isolated incidents? Sure. But, you know, America is full of over 330 million people. And I would say that 99.999% of them will not do anything violent. They don't want to attack their neighbors, no matter what their neighbors' political thoughts are or how they voted.
However, it's hard to predict what will occur after such virulent accusations of fraud and the long-term demonization of Trump supporters, who did prevail at every election level except the presidential. Protests at Electoral College meeting places were held in multiple states, and the Michigan State Capitol was closed because local police said credible threats of violence had been made. A majority of Democrats never accepted Trump's win as legitimate, and now it seems that a majority of Republicans are opposed to the Electoral College's election of Biden. That makes for a worrying pattern, but the main concern right now is, will there be significant election-related violence? Ramin Mazahari, Chicago.
Political commentator Frank Emspeck believes that U.S. President-elect Joe Biden has a difficult path ahead as millions of Americans consider his election victory as illegitimate.
If 40% of the population thinks that the government is illegitimate, which is currently the case here, and that is what President Trump has spent the last 6 weeks doing, then it becomes very, very difficult to lead on any issue. And I believe that President Trump's objective here is to make it almost impossible for President Biden to take initiatives. If President Biden also does not control the Senate, the Republicans are going to do everything they can to impede any initiatives for governance, including going back to the table for the nuclear accords or anything else that President-elect Biden might want to do to ameliorate the situation. And I think for people who want something done, they can go look at, say, 1932 or 33. President Roosevelt, you know, ran as a fiscal conservative. And it was only because there were millions of people demanding Social Security in the streets and people on strike that he moved on these issues. And I think that if there's going to be the kind of widespread reforms that we need in this country, people are going to have to put some energy behind it.
U.S. Attorney General William Barr has resigned just weeks after contradicting President Donald Trump's voter fraud claims. In a tweet, Trump confirmed that Barr will be leaving his job on December the 23rd, just before Christmas, and he will be replaced by Deputy Attorney General Jeff Rosen. The announcement came moments after members of the Electoral College formally confirmed Joe Biden as the next U.S. president. Barr has long been seen as one of Trump's staunchest allies, but his loyalty was in question, and he said that a Justice Department investigation had found no signs of major fraud in November election. Trump's legal team had accused Barr of failing to conduct a proper inquiry into the fraud claims. Moving on, the Boko Haram terrorist group has claimed responsibility for the kidnapping of hundreds of students in northwest Nigeria. Boko Haram leader made the announcement in a message on Tuesday, 4 days after they abducted the students. More than 330 people remain missing after armed men on motorcycles attacked a secondary school in Kinatsia State. Following that attack, soldiers got engaged in a fierce gun battle with assailants to rescue the abductees. The attack also forced hundreds of students to flee and hide in the surrounding area. Boko Haram is an offshoot of the Daesh terrorist group. According to UN figures, thousands have been killed and millions more displaced in a decade of Boko Haram violence in Nigeria. Asian markets have fallen across the board as surging virus infections force governments to impose tighter containment measures. Japan's benchmark Nikkei dropped after the government announced the suspension of a travel promotion program blamed for the virus surge. Benchmark indexes in Hong Kong, China, South Korea, Singapore, Indonesia, and Australia also declined. Market figures across Asia came after the market fatigue came after a lackluster day on Wall Street, where investors were waiting to see how coronavirus measures will unfold. The downbeat move comes despite optimism in markets following the approval of the COVID-19 vaccines in the U.S. and Britain, as well as new stimulus packages for the American economy. COVID-19 infections and deaths keep surging in Europe, where authorities are imposing stringent restrictions to curb the pandemic ahead of the holiday season. Italy registered 491 coronavirus-related deaths and over 12,000 new infections in 24 hours. The government is weighing new restrictions during the New Year holidays to prevent a possible spike in infections in January. Meanwhile, the UK reported over 16,000 new cases of COVID-19 with 232 deaths. British officials say London will be placed under the country's toughest restrictions following a sharp rise in daily cases and hospital admissions in the capital.
Mr. Speaker, these restrictions will come into force at midnight on Wednesday morning, because when the virus moves quickly, we must move quickly too, and we must take the actions that are not necessarily easy, but are effective. Now, I know that this is difficult news, and I know that it will mean plans disrupted, and that for businesses affected, it will be a significant blow. But this action is absolutely essential, not just to keep people safe, but because we've seen early action can help prevent more damaging and longer-lasting problems later.
Elsewhere in Europe, Germany has also reported over 16,000 new daily cases and 188 new deaths. The country will go into a partial lockdown from Wednesday until January 10th. In Turkey, the government has announced a four-day lockdown on the New Year holidays to avert a new spike in coronavirus infections. Earlier this month, Turkey imposed nationwide weekend lockdowns and daily evening curfews to contain a second wave of the pandemic. Another deadline for negotiations about a post-Brexit trade deal has come and gone. The sticking points are now access to UK fishing waters for EU vessels and corporate economic fair play rules. Bianca Rahimi has more.
More than 4 years since Britain voted by 52-48% to leave the EU, a trade deal is yet to be reached. After it became clear that the UK is hurtling towards a no-deal Brexit, Prime Minister Boris Johnson said Sunday the two sides are still very far apart on some key issues, but the UK will not be leaving the negotiating table.
What I'll say is I think that the UK should continue to try. And I think that's what the people of this country would want me to do. We're going to continue to try.
Mr. Johnson also called on Britain to get ready to trade on World Trade Organization terms. The UK will also have to decide whether to accept the mini-deals proposed by Brussels to keep planes in the air and lorries with food and medicines rolling. A no-deal might mean rising food prices and the loss of 300,000 jobs. So are Britons worried?
There's scary things like there might not be food on the shelves, like in January and February, because it's going to be a nightmare getting everything through customs. There's the whole Irish border thing. I mean, I can just go on and on and on.
I think, you know, leaving the European Union is a very, very bad idea. I think the decision was probably made by the old people, and the young people have to cope with it in the future.
Boris has let everybody down, left, right and centre. He promised the earth, he promised this ready-cooked deal, and he's just not delivered in any shape or form. It's dreadful. But on the other hand, we can't be blackmailed by Europe.
Preventing a deal is a row over Britain's fisheries. After January 1st, Europe won't have automatic access to British waters anymore, and a no deal will mean zero access. The French are particularly upset about this. Clashes in the English Channel are likely, and the UK has already bolstered its defences there with four Royal Navy ships. The EU is calling for calm, though.
Grande-Bretagne et l'Europe sont des
Great Britain and Europe are friends, partners, allies, and this will remain the case after Brexit.
The EU's Brexit negotiator is also calling for patience, saying a new trade pact with Britain is still possible this week.
Ça fait à peine 9 mois que nous négocions.
Trade of goods and services, fishing, energy, transport, the security of citizens. Never have we negotiated such an agreement in such a short space of time. We've only been negotiating for 9 months.
The EU says that Westminster has to compromise on fisheries, but the UK says it cannot be the only country in the world that does not have sovereign control over its fishing waters. Neither seem prepared to budge, and despite a new deadline, it seems a no-deal Brexit is more and more likely. Bianca Rahimi, London.
The coronavirus death toll in the United States has surpassed the grim milestone of 300,000 as the world's hardest-hit nation kicks off a mass vaccination program. The vaccinations come at one of the darkest phases of the pandemic as the U.S. confirmed caseload surpasses 6.4 million. The country also registered over 17,000 COVID-related deaths just last week, shattering its previous record and registering the largest number since the virus outbreak. Meanwhile, health officials have warned that infections will continue to rise in the coming weeks due to the holiday season. COVID-19 has also taken a heavy toll on the country's economy, with President Donald Trump facing harsh criticism for his handling of the pandemic and downplaying its threat to the public. That brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends, no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging, and to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless thou forgives it. And leave no grief unless thou takes it away. And leave no enemy. And leave no enemy unless thou repelst him. By means of in the name of Allah, the best of the names. In the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is his anger. And I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is his good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from thee, O patron of beneficence.
The Limelight.
A Danish study found that people with elevated levels of a compound called PFBA were more than twice as likely to have a severe form of COVID-19. PFBA is one of a class of industrial compounds, often called forever chemicals, that has come to contaminate soil, water, and food around the world. It has been presented as relatively safe because it stays in human blood for much less time than some of other compounds in the class and is a shorter molecule. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Sharon Lerner-Ryder. This article is published under the heading PFAS Chemical Associated with Severe COVID-19. Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. Elevated levels of a PFAS compound were associated with more severe forms of COVID-19, according to a Danish study now undergoing peer review. The research, which involved 323 patients infected with the coronavirus, found that those who had elevated levels of a chemical called PFBA were more than twice as likely to have a severe form of the disease. PFBA is one of a class of industrial compounds, often called forever chemicals, that has come to contaminate soil, water, and food around the world. It has been presented as relatively safe because it stays in human blood for much less time than some of other compounds in a class and is a shorter molecule. Both traits are thought to be indications of its innocuousness. PFBA, which was created by 3M, is based on a four-carbon chain and is gone from human blood in a matter of days. It is still in use, while PFOA, which is based on eight carbons and stays in the human blood for years, has been phased out since 2015. Though PFBA exits the bloodstream relatively rapidly, it accumulates in the lungs, which likely explains the finding of the Danish study. It's probably what's in the lungs that counts, because that's where the big COVID battle is fought, said Philip Grandjean, the principal author of the study. Grandjean's study involved 323 patients with COVID-19, 215 of whom were hospitalized. The researchers analyzed the blood of these patients for the presence of 5 PFAS compounds and found that only perfluorobutanoic acid, or PFBA, was associated with the severity of the disease. More than half of those seriously ill with COVID-19 had elevated PFBA levels in their plasma, while less than 20% of those with mild illness had elevated levels of the chemical. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention does not include PFBA in its surveillance of the blood levels of various PFAS compounds, but it is clear that the chemical is both widespread and particularly elevated in certain areas. Research conducted by 3M in 2005 showed that 20 of the 36 pooled blood samples from the general population contained PFBA. More research from the Minnesota Department of Health shows that levels of the compound are elevated in the East Metro area near a 3M plant in the suburbs of Minneapolis, St. Paul. The chemical has also been found in other parts of the world, including Vietnam, Jordan, Thailand, and Japan. PFBA was also found in the Tennessee River near a 3M plant in Decatur, Alabama, and near a 3M plant in Cordova, Illinois. And it has been found in food, including radish, peas, tomatoes, and lettuce. PFBA is used in the electronics, clothing, including water-resistant outerwear, protective gear for chemical and medical staff and firefighters, such as surgical gowns, firefighting foam, carpets, floor polish, laboratory equipment, leather treatment, food packaging, cosmetics, including body lotion and foundation, concealer, eyeshadow, powder, and bike lubricants, according to a recently published paper on the previously unknown uses of chemicals. According to the Minnesota Department of Health, which has set a safety limit for the chemical, PFBA causes changes in the liver and thyroid, as well as decreased red blood cells, decreased cholesterol, and delayed eye opening in animal experiments. A division of the Environmental Protection Agency called the Integrated Risk Information System, or IRIS, is in the process of assessing the dangers of PFBA and is scheduled to release its report in the first quarter of the coming year. Asked for comment, 3M referred The Intercept to a statement on its website asserting that the available scientific evidence does not support a causal relationship between PFAS exposures and COVID-19 health outcomes. Grandjean's previous research has shown that higher PFAS levels in children correlated to weaker response to various vaccines, and the fears the same will be true for a COVID-19 vaccine. I would think that what we have seen before is very likely to happen again, he said about the vaccines now in the development for COVID-19. Communities that have elevated levels due to industrial contamination should get special consideration when a vaccine is distributed, he said. They may need more than one or two shots recommended for everyone else, because their antibody protection may be suppressed.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
European News Bulletin.
Welcome to the News Bulletin. My name is Amina Taylor, and we're broadcasting from London. Now, we'll get to the situation of Brexit in just a moment, but first, supporters of WikiLeaks co-founder Julian Assange have reported the shocking conditions he's currently being kept in at the UK's maximum security Belmarsh prison, with fears he may die behind bars. According to several reports, a coronavirus outbreak has forced inmates to be kept in solitary confinement for extended periods. A judgment on his extradition case is expected on the 4th of January next year, and US prosecutors have indicted him on 17 espionage charges and one count of computer misuse over the publication of secret American military documents just over a decade ago. Now, those charges carry a maximum sentence of 175 years in prison. A new push to release the whistleblower is underway, with the Australian Member of Parliament George Christensen reaching out to outgoing US President Donald Trump to grant Assange a pardon. Well, John White, the author and political commentator, joins us. John, it must be said that there have been so many who believe that the WikiLeaks revelations about Hillary Clinton helped Trump to get into the White House. Can you see outgoing President Donald Trump issuing a pardon as a kind of final act of defiance?
Good evening. I mean, I do think that's entirely feasible. Trump has set his face against his own intelligence community almost from the first day he entered the White House at the beginning of 2017. And this, as you say, would be one final act of defiance as he leaves that office. But I hope he does. It would salvage for me something of his otherwise horrific legacy as president, a one-term president. And obviously there's a campaign now underway, gathering momentum by the day, in Australia, in the UK and in the US, to have him pardoned and released. This man is being persecuted, not prosecuted. And the legal briefs, the lawyers, the judges who are involved in this farce in the UK, they are acting now essentially as a posse of upper class, privately educated reprobates, acting not in the interests of justice, but in the interests of a sheriff in Washington.
Well, it's interesting you mention that, because the court case has thrown up a number of anomalies, including that the judge's husband has links to the military, and that the access that Mr. Assange has to court documents and he's had restricted time with his own legal team. Was there ever a sense here that Julian Assange would have been granted a fair trial, John?
No. This farrago has utterly debased the UK legal system. It's shown it to be a rancid, corrupt process, and I think the outcome to this process has already been determined. And the case as it is, the trial, if it can be so called, is merely part of a performance to give the sheen of legitimacy, ascribe some legitimacy to an outcome that, I think has already been determined, that Julian Assange will be extradited next year, unless Donald Trump steps in and issues a pardon.
Now we're talking about all the very negative things that have happened here when it comes to the treatment of this whistleblower. So actually, has the system worked here in deterring people from following in Assange's footsteps going forward?
Well, that's obviously what it's been designed to do, and his treatment has been so, it's almost medieval, the level of hardship, the level of persecution, what he's been subjected to, solitary confinement, held in horrible conditions. His partner's tried to send him some winter clothing, that's been denied him, he's not been issued with that yet. He's in a prison that's riven with COVID, and prior to that he was forced to spend 6 years in the Ecuadorian embassy, not trying to escape justice but seeking political asylum. And if this was happening in any other country, Venezuela, Cuba, North Korea, then we would say, well, this is just in keeping with their cultural values. We expect nothing better from those countries, given that we deem these countries to be of a lesser culture, lesser political culture and legal culture. But it's happening in the UK, a so-called bastion of human rights and legality in our world, and it's just hypocrisy to the core. And I hope everyone who's been witness to this farrago is getting an education as to the evils of this post-colonial state when push comes to shove.
Indeed, John White, thank you, as always. Now we move to some other news, because yet another deadline for negotiations about a post-Brexit deal, well, it's come and gone. On Sunday, the UK and the EU mandated negotiators to continue despite a deal or no deal target. It's an anticlimax Brits have come to expect 4 years after they voted leave. The sticking points are now access to UK fishing waters for EU vessels and corporate economic fair play rules. Bianca Rahimi fills us in.
More than 4 years since Britain voted by 52 to 48% to leave the EU, a trade deal is yet to be reached. After it became clear that the UK is hurtling towards a no-deal Brexit, Prime Minister Boris Johnson said Sunday, the two sides are still very far apart on some key issues, but the UK will not be leaving the negotiating table.
What I say is that I think that the UK should continue to try. And I think that's what the people of this country would want me to do. We're going to continue to try.
Mr. Johnson also called on Britain to get ready to trade on World Trade Organization terms. The UK will also have to decide whether to accept the mini-deals proposed by Brussels to keep planes in the air and lorries with food and medicines rolling. A no-deal might mean rising food prices and the loss of 300,000 jobs. So are Britons worried?
There's scary things like there might not be food on the shelves, like in January and February, because it's going to be a nightmare getting everything through customs. There's the whole Irish border thing. I mean, I can just go on and on and on.
I think, you know, leaving the European Union is a very, very bad idea. I think the decision was probably made by the old people, and the young people have to cope with it in the future.
Boris has let everybody down, left, right and centre. He promised the earth, he promised this ready cooked deal, and he's just not delivered in any shape or form. It's dreadful. But on the other hand, we can't be blackmailed by Europe.
Preventing a deal is a row over Britain's fisheries. After January 1st, Europe won't have automatic access to British waters anymore, and a no deal will mean zero access. The French are particularly upset about this. Clashes in the English Channel are likely, and the UK has already bolstered its defences there with 4 Royal Navy ships. The EU is calling for calm, though.
Great Britain and Europe are friends, partners, allies, and this will remain the case after Brexit.
The EU's Brexit negotiator is also calling for patience, saying a new trade pact with Britain is still possible this week.
Ça fait à peine 9 mois que nous négocions.
Trade of goods and services, fishing, energy, transport, security of citizens. Never have we negotiated such an agreement in such a short space of time. We've only been negotiating for 9 months.
The EU says that Westminster has to compromise on fisheries, but the UK says it cannot be the only country in the world that does not have sovereign control over its fishing waters. Neither seem prepared to budge, and despite a new deadline, it seems a no-deal Brexit is more and more likely. Bianca Rahimi, London.
And Jonathan Fry, the writer and commentator, is with us for his take on the weekend's developments. And Jonathan, there's still little progress that's been made on both sides. Time's running out, and some feel an extension to the transition was inevitable. So how will this go down with those who wanted to see January the 1st as Independence Day?
Well, I think what may happen is that they will perhaps agree a deal before the 31st of December, but then they will need some extra time in January for the deal to be ratified by the member states of the European Union and possibly the British Parliament as well, though it's up in the air at the moment whether MPs will actually get a vote on it. But that doesn't mean, of course, that we definitely will have a deal. It's still very much on a knife edge.
Now, Boris Johnson's attempts at negotiating directly with some of the leaders who had sticking points, France and so on, some of the newspapers here in Britain on the right, well, they took offense to that and went after Angela Merkel and Macron. Is the media tail wagging the Brexit dog, Jonathan?
Well, it's really been very depressing to see a lot of the media coverage, particularly in the right-wing conservative press. There was never any question that the EU would agree to Britain talking to individual leaders of member states. It was always going to be a collective bargaining with the EU Commission taking the lead. But we've had horrible headlines in the press yesterday, the Mail on Sunday, for example, accusing the German Chancellor, Frau Merkel, of wanting Britons to crawl over broken glass. Absolutely disgusting.
So how will Boris Johnson claim any kind of victory here?
I don't think he will be able to claim a big victory, whatever happens. If there's no deal, then no matter how much bluster he gives that no deal is quite a good outcome, everyone knows it isn't. There'll be tariffs and higher prices. It'll be awful. And if he does get a deal, it'll probably be a very weak deal, which many in his own party will think is a betrayal of what Brexit was all about. And I think his political career may well be on the line, whatever the outcome of the next few days.
Well, Boris Johnson is making himself fully acquainted with a rock and a hard place. Thank you very much, Jonathan Fry.
This is European News Bulletin broadcast by IRIB English Radio. In this program, we covered the most recent developments all over Europe. You can listen to this program on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
Welcome back to the Bulletin, Robert Carter. Well, you're going to kick things off with some more bad news for Labour leader Sir Keir Starmer. Tell us what's going on.
Absolutely. So obviously there has been a lot of talk surrounding his performance since taking over the biggest opposition British political party. And one of the biggest factors which could determine that would be the alleged Max exodus, which is taking place within the membership party. His predecessor, Jeremy Corbyn, was praised for reviving interest, especially among the youth in British political circles, and in particular, a huge increase in the membership numbers. However, what we're seeing under Keir Starmer potentially is the opposite, so a significant drop in people joining the party, and in fact, there could be a lot of people quitting. We don't know those figures for sure, they're only alleged because the Labour Party won't release them, but the recent NEC election that took place saw a significantly less number of people taking part in that election, which of course takes place within the party circle, so it's a local internal election process, and significantly less people took part. So it seems as if Keir Starmer is pretty unpopular and is not performing as well, at least internally within Labour, than the current leader, Keir Starmer. That's what's being suggested. We actually have some social media reaction, which will bring you a bit more of the figures behind what's happening. So perhaps we'll bring up the first tweet and see what was said. It's from Socialist Voice, a critic of the current opposition leader. It says that 293,000 Labour Party members never even bothered to vote in this year's leadership election, and only 27% voted in the recent NEC election. So Keir Starmer is hemorrhaging the membership. NEC turnout could be a result of a collapse in the membership. It's obviously suggesting that the figures are looking pretty bad internally at Labour for Keir Starmer. And the second tweet, let's bring that up on screen. It's a similar criticism. It's from Rosie, who says, it's about time that the Labour Party published their real membership numbers, not the figures prior to when Starmer took over, which were, of course, related to Corbyn rather than Starmer, especially as it seems that Starmer and the rest of his ilk no longer believe in the members' right to freedom of speech. So a little hint there at the gagging of free speech on, say, Israel, for example.
Speaking of the occupation entity, what's Algeria's warning to Tel Aviv?
A major warning coming out of Algeria. This obviously comes off the back of the news that Morocco, the neighboring country of Algeria, is normalizing ties with the Zionist regime. Algerian Prime Minister has been pretty clear. He says that he is very concerned about Israeli presence on the borders of Algeria. So obviously we know the Israeli regime takes part in covert action within the Middle East and the Muslim world, and these normalization deals could be a new opportunity for the Israeli regime to exploit that and try and go against Muslim countries which remain loyal to the Palestinian cause, such as Algeria for the time being. So let's go to the social media reaction and see what's been said. Again, it's criticism of the move overall from Sailing Serene, who says Morocco's normalization with Israel isn't the same like it has been for UAE or Bahrain, for example. The government has been accusing Morocco of being a Zionist stronghold in North Africa for years. Add this with the US recognition of Western Sahara, the reaction from Algeria will be severe. And then the second tweet I have, again, is also issuing some warnings here. It's from Abdul Mehdi, who says, yes, anyone putting a bet on Algeria being the next nation after Morocco to do some kind of normalization deal with Israel, rip up your ticket now. So Algeria, standing by the Palestinian cause, and I guess that's a little bit of light at the end of the tunnel. Not all of these countries are siding with Israel. Let's hope that they remain determined to stand by Palestine.
Well, let's see, because of course now Algeria has clearly made itself a target there. You know, it's put its political head above the parapet, as it were. Robert Carter, good to see you. Until next time. Now we move on to some other news now. Worrying stuff from Spain, where two neo-Nazis have been arrested in the country for selling drugs as part of a plot to make money to buy weapons for a future race war. According to Spanish police, the pair, who have not been publicly named, intended to use the money to buy weapons to create a, quote, isolated white supremacist group. After a year-long investigation, officers made the arrest in the northwestern Spanish regions of Andalusia and Pamplona after tracking a series of dangerous messages on social media. Among the messages were correspondence between the pair. Police discovered posts praising Brenton Tarrant, the Australian-born terrorist who murdered over 50 Muslim worshippers in Christchurch, New Zealand, back in 2019. The neo-Nazi pair have been released on bail pending a court appearance. London will move to Tier 3, England's highest level of coronavirus restrictions, from Wednesday. The sudden development comes just a few days after data recorded from the UK's Office for National Statistics showed that London's coronavirus cases were off the chart, with more than 24,000 new cases recorded just last week. Further data also showed 22 of the 32 London boroughs across England are currently above the national average. Speaking on the COVID-19 pandemic, the city's mayor, Sadiq Khan, warned that winter could see even more devastating rise in COVID-19 deaths if people did not follow the rules. Fighting continued on Sunday between Azerbaijan and Armenia in the breakaway region of Nagorno-Karabakh, violating the November ceasefire that ended the bloody conflict. Azerbaijan's defense ministry said four of its soldiers were killed when their units were attacked in areas adjacent to Nagorno-Karabakh, while authorities in Armenia said six of their troops had been wounded. Speaking on the broken ceasefire deal, Russian military commander Rostam Merdov said the violation had been averted by the action of the Russian peacekeeping force, but did not specify which of the sides violated the deal first. The reports come only weeks after a 6 week bloody war, which resulted in a death of over 5,000 soldiers. This was ended when Azerbaijan and Armenia signed a ceasefire deal. Well, Richard, Sudan, it's going to be the worst-kept secret, but Britain's Prince Andrew's been caught out. But before you tell us that little bit of royal update, some more bad news, Richard.
So we are seeing reports that another black man has been shot dead by the police in the US in the Houston area. We know that Joshua Feast, aged 22, last Wednesday, was shot in the back by police officer Jose Santos. Now, we know that Joshua Feast was under investigation, but already the community are asking questions as to why the investigation resulted in the death of Joshua Feast. Now, what we do know that's interesting is that initially the local police were apparently not giving out much information and were not being transparent at all. One of the pieces of information they did get out was the race or skin colour of Joshua Feast, but there were not initially details about the officer involved. Those details have now been released, and imagine that Jose Santos, who was the shooter, actually has a history, a recorded history of violence against black men. He was accused in 2013 of punching and kicking an innocent black man and holding that black man's head under the water, threatening to drown him, prompting cries of "I can't breathe." So many questions, Amina, one of which is, how did Jose Santos, with a history of violence against black men, remain on the police force, leading to the death of Joshua Feast?
Richard, it seems whenever we're on together, and I start the introduction by saying yet another police incident with yet another young black person, people might be saying, well, put on another record, you know, isn't there something else? But the truth is, this is now an epidemic, and I think the reaction on social media will give some kind of credence to that.
Absolutely. Let's go first to Devin Green, who says, this is my issue with the criminal justice reform police brutality conversation. It requires death to keep it going. The officer that killed Joshua Feast also kicked and punched an innocent man in 2013, and I'd be willing to bet he had other brutality issues that the police department hid. Very pertinent reaction there. Also from Breeze McDonald, we have, Joshua Feast was murdered by cops in the back. We want justice. Stay woke. The work has just begun. Get in good trouble and be heard.
Indeed. Now, speaking of trouble that might not be so good, some more very disturbing questions for one of Queen Elizabeth's sons to answer.
Just when we thought this story had gone quiet, it turns out that apparently Prince Andrew did stay at the disgraced Jeffrey Epstein's mansion in 2001. Now, this is according to sources and reports from the UK press, the Daily Mail. And the source said to the paper, not only did Andrew lie about staying at Jeffrey Epstein's mansion, he also lied about the now infamous Pizzagate alibi that he gave. He claimed he was at a Pizza Express. And apparently, the prince's own daughter has said that she can't recollect any such birthday party at a Pizza Express ever happening. So this is massively embarrassing from the prince. And of course, this was off the back of the famous car crash interview with the BBC. We're seeing video of that on the screen now, when Prince Andrew stated that he did not stay at Jeffrey Epstein's mansion. He only visited. And now it looks as though, lo and behold, who would have thought it, Prince Andrew was lying.
Oh, I, for one, am shocked. Also, I think from that interview, if you recall, one of the takeaways was the prince couldn't sweat. We'll just move on from that one, Richard. Some social media reaction to this.
Indeed. indeed. Let's go first to D, who says, I see Prince Andrew is trending, wondering how many hours and minutes it will be before something is being dug up to get at Meghan Markle, solely in order to take the heat off him. Astute observers will know the press always do diversionary tactics. And Rachel says, once he had uttered the Sweat and Pizza Express absurdities, did anyone really believe the rest of Prince Andrew's interview with Emily Matlis? This country really is enthralled to the upper class.
So, Rich, wouldn't it have been just more appropriate for Prince Andrew during that interview to say, listen, he was a friend. When what happened became public, that this man was a pervert, a paedophile, that I broke ties and I wanted to do the right thing. What's with all of this cloak and dagger, which clearly people would be now trying to disprove what he said publicly?
Indeed, and let's not forget the other excuse Prince Andrew gave in that interview. He said the reason he didn't cut ties is because he has a tendency to be too honourable. I don't think anyone's going to forget that anytime soon. But it seems as though Amina, the prince's honour is once again being brought into a sharp question.
Right, more on that, I'm sure, as time goes on. Richard Sudan, thank you, monitoring that story as well for us. And thank you. Stay safe.